The Extraordinary Ordinary is brought to you in partnership with Coca-Cola Euro-Pacific Partners. Hello, and welcome to The Extraordinary Ordinary, the podcast from Women of the Year, which recognises and celebrates the achievements of remarkable women you've probably never heard of, but whose passion, dedication, hard work, and fierce determination have changed society, lives, and the world in all kinds of inspiring ways. I'm Diane Kenwood. I'm a journalist and broadcaster, and I'm one of the team at Women of the Year. If you've ever considered making a career pivot, I can pretty much guarantee it wouldn't be quite as life-changing as the one made by our guest on the Extraordinary Ordinary podcast today. When she decided to sign up for a fishing trip off the coast of Norfolk in 2012, Ashley Mullinger could never have imagined that she would fall in love with being out at sea and fishing, and that that growing passion would eventually lead to her leaving her office job in logistics management to become a full-time fisherman. Or indeed, that in 2022, she would become the first woman ever to win the under 10 metre, that's a reference to the size of the boat she fishes from, Fisherman of the Year. Ashley, welcome to the Extraordinary Ordinary.
Hi, Diane. How are you?
Yeah, I'm really good, thank you. I'd really like to start off painting a picture of what day-to-day life is like for a fisherman. So can you sort of paint a picture? What do you get up, you have your breakfast. I'm assuming that you start at different times, or is it the same time every day?
You assume correctly, although I quite often skip breakfast. I know there's going to be people out there that's like, you can't do that. It's the most important meal of the day. But sometimes if you're getting up for work at 1 o'clock in the morning, you're really not in the mood for eating. But the day generally does start at different times because Wells, next to the sea where I fish from, is a tidal harbour, which means there is only access to the open sea for a 4 hour window twice in a 24 hour period. So the day starts depending on what time the tide is that day.
Okay, so having not eaten your breakfast and gone out at whatever time the tide dictates, what actually happens? You get to your boat in the harbour and does it have to be loaded up or?
So sometimes we will load the boat up in the morning just before we go with the bait that we're going to need with our pack up for the day. Sometimes we'll load it up with bait when we finish from the day before, which just makes things a lot quicker and a lot easier. When we get down to the boat, it's a case of turning everything on and firing up the engine. There are safety checks that we have to do before we leave, which involves things like just checking the oil in the engine, checking there's water there, like check the engine's all good, turning all your equipment on before you leave the harbour. So things like your computer for your navigation, your radar, just getting everything fired up and running, VHF radio. And then it's a case of getting out of the harbour, which can take somewhere 20 minutes, half an hour, because we're about a mile to the sea from the quay wall through a meandering channel.
And you're fishing for what? Because also that's the other thing we probably should describe.
We are a pot fishing boat primarily, which is whelk pots and crab pots. And our main catch, therefore, is whelks and crabs and lobsters.
So the pots are already out in sea and you're going to see what you've caught in them.
That's right. We don't do lots and lots and lots of pots. We're a smaller boat. We're a smaller concern, but we might haul somewhere between 350 and 500 pots in a day and they stay at sea. So the last time you'd have done them, you'd have rebaited them and left them to go and check the next time you do them. How often you go and do them and how often you check them will depend on the seasonality of the catch. It will depend on things like how big of the tide's been, what's the weather been doing. You know, we might not have been able to have physically gotten to sea because of poor weather. So you could be doing pots that you hauled the day before, or you could be doing pots that you haven't hauled for 2 to 3 weeks.
And once you get out to where the pots are, what do you then do?
So depending again on time of year and what you're targeting, the amount of time it takes to actually get to where the pots are could be anything from 20 minutes to 3 hours. Which sounds ludicrous, considering that if somebody told you your work commute for the day was going to be 3 hours there and 3 hours back, you probably wouldn't consider it. But when it comes to fishing, that is an extremely normal amount of time to spend steaming to where your pots are. And once you're there, in that time period that you've had, however long it might be, you will have set the boat up ready to fish for the day. So that would entail making sure that you've got enough bait ready to go so that you're not wasting time sorting bait out, whether that be cutting bait, whether that be just taking bait from its boxes and putting it into somewhere where you can work with it quickly and effectively. It will mean making sure you've got boxes down to put your catch in once you're there, making sure you've got things like our measuring tools to measure crabs to make sure they're landable size and lobsters, things like that. Making sure you've got your lobster bands and your lobster banding tools nearby so that you can quickly put the rubber bands on the lobster claws. So you'll have done that for, you know, while you've been steaming off to wherever your pots might be. And then once you're there, it will be a case of then hauling your strings of pots, and all your pots will be theoretically in groups to make your work as productive as possible. So for us, our crab pots are in strings of 20 to 25 pots, all interconnected with ropes. And we will haul one string of those. And as the pots come up, they will be emptied, they will be rebaited, they will be stacked on deck in a certain order, ready for, once they're done, to be shot away in the reverse order out of the door of the boat and left until the next time we go and haul them.
I'm going to have to ask what I'm sure is a very stupid question. How on earth do you find the pots?
GPS plotters. It's a bit like sat nav for the sea.
Ah,
yeah. It looks like I say sat nav for the sea. It's essentially just a screen full of blue, like the color blue, various different contour lines to show you different depths, different sandbank heights. It will show you obstructions, things like wind farms. And when you set your pots in a string, you will create basically a line. You start drawing a line with your little boat icon on there, and it will plot where you are and draw that line for you. And you stop it when the pots are finished going out the door so that the next time you go, you can go and find them easily.
And there isn't any chance that you'll mistake them for someone else's pots or vice versa?
Generally, no. I mean, there are times perhaps in certain areas where you might be, we've got certain pieces of ground that are really productive at certain times of year, and it can certainly become a little bit competitive in these spaces. And people will shoot their gear, as in pots, very, very close to each other. And you could mistake someone's pots for your pots, but generally you get a feel for what kind of rope that you use, what kind of can or end marker you would have floating on the surface. And yeah, you would know the minute you got hold of somebody else's can on the surface and started to pull it through the hauler that it wasn't yours before you'd even got to the pots themselves.
And so in terms of percentage of time, you spent 3 hours roughly getting to where your pots are. How long do you spend actually hauling the pots up, taking out the catch, rebaiting them, and then putting them back before you turn around or move on to the next set? How long will you actually be out at sea doing the fishing?
Be somewhere 5-6 hours. And the clock really is ticking in some locations. If you have had to have one of those uppermost 3 hour steams to where you're going, you have to really work up against the clock, because if you want to make your day viable, you need to haul as many of your pots as you can. And silly little things, like if there's been a tangle in your rope and you have to sort that out and you have to get that clear, that will obviously, the clock is always ticking and you have to get back in order to be able to make it back for the next tide.
Yeah, of course. So you continue to be dominated by the tide. I'd like to know what happens when you get back, but when you're actually out at sea, what's it like? What are you wearing? Is it sounds like the work is incredibly physical. Is it hard physically?
It's not as hard physically as I think people would think. There are different jobs on the boat for definite, and Nigel, the skipper, he actually does the majority, if not all, of the hauling of the pots over the hydraulic winch, and that can be really physically difficult if you've got really, really heavy pots. But your body very quickly learns what muscles it needs to use in order to do the job you're doing and stay upright. And you find yourself using muscles and building strength in places that you didn't even realize existed. When I first started, so it's very hard to describe a whelk pot, but I'm going to try. But they're basically recycled 25 liter drums that have normally held some kind of liquid in their previous life. And they've had, if you were to imagine sort of a 25 liter drum and you were to turn it on its side and cut a rectangle out, put a mesh net on top with a hole in so that a whelk could crawl in the open aperture. And they are weighted with concrete in the bottom to keep them heavy. The drawstrings, if they've been left for a little while without hauling, they can get really gritty and it can be really hard to undo that hole in the middle with a drawstring pull. And the strength, I didn't have any strength in my wrists when I first started, and I would find trying to open this drawstring, to open this mesh, really hard work. I used to always like show them to Nige and be like, Nige, can you open this? But I very rarely have to ask him now, which is quite nice.
And I know that also you play music while you're at sea, don't you?
Yes, we have outside speakers as well, so we can hear it while we're on deck.
Do you have particular playlists that you like to use over and over, or do you adjust them according to the weather or the sea or, you know, the seasons?
Yeah, definitely we adjust them. I mean, if I had my way, we'd be listening to musicals and Disney songs all day, but that's not going to fly with Nige. I know that when we've had really early starts that are really antisocial, definitely a good bit of heavy classic rock is good to blow the cobwebs out. And some days you might have particularly sort of sloppy days, and there are a few sort of sea shanty style songs that are good by a Newfoundland band called the Darina Harvey Band. They're really good to listen to, really quite upbeat and rocky takes on classic sea shanty songs. And when it's really hot, we like a bit of either country and western or a bit of reggae. So yeah, we do vary it up.
Fantastic. So now you've got your catch and you're coming back into harbour. What happens to what you've caught?
Depends on what it is. To begin with, I mean, the whelks, we'll talk about them. They will go to a processing company in King's Lynn and they'll be craned off via a Hiab lorry. I mean, each box of whelks weighs somewhere around 50 kilos. So they're really quite heavy. So a Hiab will come and collect them. Most of the time a Hiab. Sometimes we have to physically lug them up the quay wall, which is never a fun task. But they'll go to King's Lynn and then be processed. And then for the most part, will end up in Korea. There's a massive market out there for them. They're almost like a delicacy. The crabs and lobsters, we will manually hoik up the wall, which involves Nigel standing on deck with a box of crabs and offering up to me, stood at the top of the wall with a metal hook to drag it up with and then load it into the back of the truck. And they stay fairly locally, the crabs. We run them down to a guy called Andy, who has the shellfish processing facility. He supplies a lot of the local restaurants and he has his own stall on the quay as well, where he sells dressed crab. Our lobsters might go to a number of different places. So I have a buyer in Suffolk and he has a small fishmonger's called A Passion for Seafood, and he'll only buy small scale day boat fish and shellfish, and he will sell all his fish with a backstory, essentially. And because he's doing that and he's making that kind of effort, he will ultimately charge for that. So it means that he can give us a fairer price for what we catch, which is great. We'll also sell them to local pubs and restaurants directly. And in recent weeks, I've also been selling direct to the public on the quay, who've been really quite shocked at the price of a live lobster when they compare it to what they're paying in places like restaurants.
Yeah. You have said that one of the things that really concerns you about, you know, the British fishing industry and the fish consumption that goes on in this country is that we here don't eat enough British seafood and that we should be eating more regional fish rather than non-regional fish. What should we be eating, and how do you go about re-educating people to understand doing that and how it supports the fishing industry?
Do you know, Diane, I think the re-education of people is important to know what's in season and what's going to be a responsible choice to eat. But I think a lot of the problem is it's not the lack of want from the general British public, it's the lack of availability to the British public. Because if you go into any local supermarket, it's going to be really, really hard for you to find local produce. The small scale fishmonger is pretty much, you know, a really rare thing to see on the British high street. And I think the problem is not being able to get our products to the end consumer easily. I mean, we export 80% of all fish that's caught here.
Across the country?
Across the country, yeah. 80% of fish caught in this country is all exported abroad.
Blimey.
Yeah, because it's easy to do that by comparison to trying to find routes to market for a small-scale fisherman. Take our case, for example. You know, we work potentially 12 to 14-hour day at sea, and then I don't have any local fish markets near us. The closest is Lowestoft. That's a 3-hour round trip. And it's really hard to try and get what you're selling into those places. And you might only be a small scale boat. You might not have, you know, tons and tons for sale. So to make it viable, to get those logistics in place, it's really, really difficult. So, I mean, we do a little bit of fish, which we've started in the last year, really. And we're doing mackerel and we do cod. And we've recently just found squid as well, which is really interesting. And I've started selling direct from the boat and on the, you know, just putting a little pop-up fish shop. I mean, the town doesn't have a fishmongers anymore. And I've had locals come stop by and say, this is a rattling good idea. It's just so hard to reach the British public with it. I mean, there are online sales for people that do want to perhaps try and buy small day boat fish. And there are some great retailers online. It's just a case of having to do a little bit of research to see who's who and who's selling what and where from.
Let's talk a bit also about how much you're allowed to catch, because, you know, obviously issues like sustainable fishing, we do hear quite a lot about. And how does that impact you and what you do and the sort of catch that you are looking for and bringing back?
With the majority of what we do, so the shellfish, as an example, so your whelks, your crabs, your lobsters, they are all what's known as a non-quota species. So they aren't managed via a total weight limit that you're allowed to take. You can essentially take as much as you like, but that doesn't mean that there's not other management tools in place in order to protect those stocks. So things like minimum landing sizes for crabs, lobsters and whelks we have. In certain areas, we have pot limitations as to how many pots we're allowed to have in any one area. We have restrictions on bait that we can and can't use in certain areas. Certain requirements for pot design, so you're only allowed to have certain features of your pot in certain areas as well. So just because there's not a amount, there is other limits in place.
So much about the sea that dominates the headlines is around green energy and wind farms that we also hear a lot about. How is that kind of thing impacting on you and fishing communities?
I know that there is a need for green energy. Absolutely, I do. But certainly, if you were to take our stretch of coastline, which I believe is the biggest centre for offshore wind power, and I want to say in the world, I might have to check that fact, but certainly it's big. I mean, we have five or six wind farms near us, and they do cost fishing grounds, and they do force fishermen into smaller areas whilst these sites are being constructed. And you have to consider what is the impact of that. Because if you're pushing people out of certain areas to all fish amongst each other, a piece of ground that perhaps was sustainable for one boat to work might not be as sustainable for two or three boats to work. And we don't know a lot about the long-term impacts of adding these kinds of infrastructures into the marine environment and what it's doing to ecosystems there. And it also creates a lot of angst sometimes within communities, because fishermen are paid to move out of the way, and it has created a lot of inorganic growth within certain fishing communities, I feel. So people have bought more pots, they've bought more efficient boats that are perhaps faster, can stay out in more weathers. And every time a wind farm is looking at extending, which happens quite regularly, or they're looking at putting a new wind farm in, which again happens very regularly, the likelihood is that somebody's always got pots in the way of where they want to be, because they probably paid for them 4 years previous with the money that they were given. And things like that do create greed, unnecessary greed in communities, and that can have a detrimental effect. And it's something that I see, but I don't think anybody's talking about.
You're very much aware of the need for and the want for being a voice in the industry and for the industry. When you went into it, you obviously went into it because you fell in love with it. Have you been surprised at how political it is? I mean, you know, we read about it in the media, but from the inside, have you been surprised, disappointed, frustrated, all of the above?
I'd say all of the above, but definitely frustrated. The way the fishing industry works is so complicated that you would need to sit down with somebody for a good hours to explain what has happened in the past, in the last, you know, 50 years, and what we have now as a result of what has happened within the last 50 years. I certainly feel frustrated when you speak to fishermen that have been in the industry for a very, very long time. And there are a couple in that I can think of in particular that I know that have just given up because of the way that things are going, the way that they predict what might happen in the future. And they don't want to do it anymore because it's become a space that they don't even feel welcome in anymore because of the legislative changes that have happened and that will be happening. The industry, I knew a little bit about it before I obviously went into it. I mean, a Brexit prime example of fishing, commercial fishing in the mass media. But Brexit hasn't really happened. And I think to understand why, you need to go back and look at where we've been to understand where we're going with it. But we have started to take back some of our fishing rights, but we haven't been able to get rid of a lot of European fishing within our own territorial waters. And there are legislative reasons for that based on the last 50 years of management. So it is frustrating, very frustrating. Mm.
Is it something that you would like to get more involved in, do you think, in the future?
Yes and no. I mean, I definitely want to be involved, and I definitely want there to be an awareness from the British public about how their British fishing industry works, because the way I see it, we are an asset of the people of Great Britain, and we have the privilege of farming a resource for them. So I definitely feel like I have the need to help bring that to the people of the country. I don't have the answers. I don't know what the answers are, but I would certainly like to be at the table to hear people's suggestions and ask questions of people and get people to look at things from perhaps a different perspective in management. Definitely.
I suppose the other thing you can't help but be an advocate for, or at least a representative of, and that's women in the fishing industry. There aren't very many of you, are there?
There's more than there was. It's looking up. It's
every, good.
I know. When I first started, there was probably three of us. And now I think there's definitely more than 20, which is, it doesn't sound a lot, but in an industry where there's only 11,000 fishermen as it is, 20 is quite a big number.
Yeah, that's great. That's brilliant. How have you found it being a woman in the industry? Were you welcomed? Was there suspicion? Was there, I don't know, ridicule?
How have I found it? Generally great. Nobody has treated me any different because I was a woman, or if they have, I haven't really noticed it, or it hasn't been an issue. I accept that there are things that I cannot do physically, but that's not because I'm a woman. That's just because I can't lift a box that's 50 kilos from from, you know, from the floor to my waist. There are a lot of men that can't do that too. I think there's people that don't particularly agree with it, but that's their issue, not mine. I definitely get support from fishermen around the country, around the world, actually, from, you know, through social media as the female fisherman on Instagram. People do reach out with messages of support. And also, I have obviously non-fisherman followers on there who are really interested about all sorts of different things. And they ask questions. They're like, sorry if this is a silly question. It's like, it's not a silly question. This is a job that is done behind closed doors. You can't just pop your head in on a fishing boat and see what's going on. So by all means, ask questions, watch. If you don't understand something, ask me to explain it. And I'll always, it might take me a while to reply to messages, but I'll always reply and try and explain things in a layperson's terms.
I love your feed. And I think that's such a valuable thing to offer people an insight into. If you had, you know, the elevator pitch for being a fisherman as a woman, what would it be?
I would definitely say that if it's a job that if you like to be challenged in new ways every single day and like being outside, like the fresh air, like working physically, then it's the job for you. I certainly found that being in an office, I would be, this is going to sound really out there, but I'd be living inside my mind most of the time, just using my brain to think about what I was doing and how I was doing it. And how I would respond to this email, how I would deal with that problem that was coming up. This job relies on your body to push you along, and to be able to use your body and your mind together is the most liberating thing, I think. You know, to rely on the strength of your arms, your hands, your wrists, your legs, your feet, your ankles, being able to rely on all of you really puts you into a really present moment. And I know that sounds really quite spiritual and deep, but it's very true.
I think it sounds perfect. That was literally the ideal elevator pitch. You nailed it, Ashley. It's been such an absolute pleasure talking to you for today's episode. I've loved the insight that you've been able to give us into what it's like to be a fisherman and, you know, a little bit about this incredibly complicated and really important industry. So thank you so much for that. Before I let you go, we do have to ask you, of course, the four questions that we ask all our podcast guests. So here goes question number one. Who is the woman who are the women who have inspired you?
I grew up in a household of women. My mum, my sister, my dad wasn't around a lot from a certain age onwards. And my mum and my sister continue to inspire me every single day. But I think further than that, I feel inspired by women who are in countries that where they don't have the same rights that we have. And I certainly feel grateful that I am able to make my own choices as far as, you know, what I do for a job, the way that I look, the way that my body is treated. And there are women out there that don't have that, but they continue to fight and for what is right. And they are inspiring.
That makes brilliant and perfect sense. Thank you for such a great answer. Question number two, what would your advice be to your younger self?
Definitely to not try and people please so much, just accepting the fact that perhaps sometimes people aren't necessarily going to agree with me, my opinions, my views, and just being okay with that.
Question number three, what's the one thing you can't live without?
People, other people. Human interaction. Which is really odd considering that I work in one of the most isolated places.
Brilliant. And finally, what's something about you that would surprise people to know?
It's when I meet people and they say, well, what do you do? And you almost dread answering because you know you're going to get a, really? You do that? What? You? Yes. Yes, I'm a fisherman. I'm a commercial fisherman. That's what I do for a living. What, out on a boat at the sea? Yeah. Do you ever get seasick? You know, you get, and then you get a barrage of questions because people are interested and people are intrigued. And it certainly doesn't fit the stereotype image of a fisherman that people have in their heads. So yeah, it's got to be that one.
Ashley, thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure speaking to you today. And thank you for being such a wonderfully informative, interesting and enjoyable guest on The Extraordinary Ordinary. And remind people just one last time, where can they find you on Instagram?
@TheFemaleFisherman.
Wonderful. Thanks again.
Thank you very much for having me.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, please rate and review us, as it helps people to find us. To find out more about Women of the Year, go to womenoftheyear.co.uk.
This episode was presented by Diane Kenwood and produced by Claire Lynch.
The Extraordinary Ordinary is brought to you in partnership with Coca-Cola Euro-Pacific Partners. They're one of the leading consumer goods companies in the world, making, moving and selling some of the world's most loved brands. CCEP make, employ, manufacture and distribute locally, maintaining a strong commitment to their communities. CCEP's success depends on their people. They want CCEP to be a great place to work, where people can grow, be happy and be well in a safe, open, diverse and inclusive workplace.